sure. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you.
Each and every night, we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called solutions, the topics you want to hear and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet.
Alexandra Robbins with us. She is the New York Times bestselling author of Pledge. Her latest book is The Geek Shall Inherit the Earth, Popularity, Quirks, Theories, and Why Outsiders Thrive After High School. She's a journalist, written for several publications, including Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, and The Washington Times. Her book include, again, Pledge, The Secret Lives of Sororities, The Secrets of the Tomb, about George W. Bush's secret society, Skull and Bones. And Alexandra, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about geeks, there's so many definitions of a geek. Years ago, a geek was somebody who, quote unquote, hid in the closet. They weren't social. They didn't do anything. Today, if you say you're a geek, it's a badge of honor.
Yeah, and I want to make clear that the title of my book is The Geek Shall Inherit the Earth. It's not just about geeks. Geeks is just an umbrella term. Really, this book is about all outsiders, all people who do not sit at that one popular table. But you're absolutely right. Geek has better connotations than it used to be because geeks now have some sort of technological expertise, and that's something that, at least in adulthood, people pretty much revere.
Sure, and something that they move to. But when we talk about outsiders today, what made you look at outsiders? What was it that turned the light bulb on for you that says this needs to be addressed?
You know, I give a lot of lectures at schools across the country, and I kept noticing that the students who I was most drawn to, when I got to know them a little bit, they were almost apologetic about their social status, as if they were saying, well, yeah, but I'm not that cool because I don't sit at the popular table. And I wanted to say, but you're going to be such an awesome adult. You're a fantastic person now, and you need to know just to hang in there. I felt like there had to be a sort of It Gets Better campaign for all outsiders.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing that the loner, the outsider type. I had a high school reunion a year or two back, and I talked to one of the guys that I went to high school with, and he was one of the loners. He was a geek in the time when the geeks were not people that you wanted to run around with. They were socially, you know, just get out of my space kind of people. And he always got A's. He didn't talk to a lot of people. And when I talked to him, it was interesting. He became a scientist. He was out on his boat. He was, you know, vacationing, multi-million dollars and whatever. And I think you're absolutely right, because what these people are learning in school is how to emotionally deal with what comes up. The popular ones don't do that. So when they get out, they're going to become the truck drivers and so on and so forth. They can't deal with life. These kids are being taught to deal with life early on. And if they catch that, if they understand it, man, what a difference their life could make.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. So for the book, not only did I follow six outsiders in high school, but to get to the other side of the story, I followed one popular girl. And what you're saying definitely holds true. What happens when you're at that popular table is you not only don't learn how to emotionally deal with things, but you end up repressing parts of yourself and hiding parts of yourself in order to conform to the crowd. And that's why you come out in adulthood not really knowing who you are, because you spent your formative years trying to be somebody you're not.
And you know what they have today, which I think is something that did not happen years and years ago. When I was in junior high school and high school, the bully was somebody who chased you home, smacked you once, it was over with, and he went on to smack somebody else. The bully today is a whole different bully. You got the cyber bully, the rest of it. And if you get these people who are, and I'm going to go to the back of your front cover, the loner, the popular bitch, the nerd, the new girl, etc. You take the loner. And you take the nerd, you take a couple of these, the weird girl, and they fall prey to the bully today. And that in and of itself is dangerous because kids kill themselves.
Yes, yes, you're right, and it is so much more exhausting to be a student today than in the past. You bring up a good point with cyberbullying. What Facebook does, while, you know, I love Facebook, I'm on it all the time, probably too often, but what it does is it takes the cafeteria setting out of school. I call it the online cafeteria, and it allows students to congregate in this public space, mostly unsupervised, basically 24 hours a day. So kids feel like they have to be their own publicists, you know, monitoring their photos and their statuses and all that. And it also is a big window for bullying, because people feel so much more detached when they're on the internet. And that can be really dangerous.
Now, one of the things that I've looked at also, and we look at some of the girls, the new girl, et cetera, the weird girl, you know, and so on and so forth, but the loner types. And I think a girl's definition of what a girl should be in high school, in junior high school, et cetera, however they've got it broken down today, is different than it was, 15, 20, 25 years ago. The culture is different, and I think it would be so hard for some of these young women to grow up today, because there's more demands, there's more expected of them, because they're supposed to, you know, hit a certain height and define themselves in a certain way. That in and of itself also could be a problem.
Yeah, I agree, and I wouldn't even just limit it to girls. I talked to hundreds of students across the country, and boys told me things like, it's really hard, and, you know, an eighth grader told me that he felt pressure to live up to some ideal body standard for boys, because he said, you know, my biceps aren't very big, and I know they're supposed to be, and boys told me that you'd rather be overweight than underweight, because if you're underweight, you're going to be a target. So there's an image concern among kids these days that's really in the back of their minds constantly.
Well, actually, when you really think about this, Alexandra, why isn't this a class in junior high school or middle school today?
You know, I think it should be, but schools are too concerned now with this one-size-fits-all curriculum that's run by standardized tests. So, you know, are they going to add something that's emotionally developmental that'll actually help kids stop picking on each other and forming these social hierarchies? No, because they're busy cutting away science and art and PE and music classes already.
Sure. Now, I have the book in front of me, and my feeling about it is basically this. If you can catch this before it happens, if you can anticipate some of the problems before it happens, and it gives some of these kids the reason, quote unquote, a reason to live. I don't mean literally live, but a reason to live their life, something to look forward to, and to realize being a loner has its merits. It's got its advantages, but you've got to be able to recognize the advantage before you can use it in any way, shape, or form.
Yes, that's absolutely right, and that's basically why I wrote the book.
Okay, so, all right, now, who is getting this? Is this going to parents? Is this going to kids? How is it being received?
Oh, it's being received really well. I wrote it in a style that would appeal to both parents and kids. You know, it's nonfiction, and kids don't usually pick up nonfiction. They go pick up the vampire books. There is no vampire in this book. However, I wrote it like a young adult book, so that is a pretty quick read. So students are picking it up and saying thank you, and parents are picking it up and saying, oh, this is going to help my son or daughter. You know, it just came out, so it's just sort of hitting audiences now.
Well, okay. Well, let me ask you this. If you were a teenager, if you were 14, 15, 16 years old, and you could have had this book when you were 14, 15, 16 years old, how would it have impacted or changed your own life?
Oh, my God. I wish I had this book when I was in high school, because I would have felt so much better about staying home on Friday nights so often. Basically, the point is to show students that it is dangerous to be in the popular crowd, and it is beneficial to be proud of who you are, quirks and all, and to basically let your quirk flag fly. Just be who you are, and people are going to appreciate it. And if you are excluded, that's really the main point of this book, is if you are excluded, there is nothing at all wrong with you. Nothing having to do with a flaw. It probably means that people are zeroing in on something that's going to make you an extraordinary adult.
Okay, define exclusion. When I say that, exclusion isn't necessarily just you can't join and participate in some of the groups and organizations in school that you would like to do. But exclusion, there's a little more to it than that. And exclusion in and of itself is also a choice of some of these kids. They've decided that this is how I am, and part of how I am, the way I define myself, you have to be excluded. You have to be a loner. You have to be a this. So I would venture to guess kids actually take the part on because in their own mind, they've chosen that's who they are. At least they've got identity. They've defined themselves. One of the biggest problems that we face today, Alexandra, is we don't have identity, and that's where the problems start. So if I can identify myself into a category, then I'm going to be the best loser I can possibly be.
Yeah, that's true. I probably wouldn't use the term loser. I think that's
that was for me. Oh, I just said probably. Loser. If that's what it's going to be.
But I know what you mean.
Yeah.
You see, it's actually natural for kids this age to try to form groups and to exclude people from those groups because they want to define their identity as clearly as possible. And these, at this age group, they want to define their identity by their group. So it's natural. And it's not necessarily a personal thing if you're excluded. And you're right. Exclusion is a term that I use just sort of as an umbrella because, you know, not everybody is bullied. In school,
no.
And I think sometimes there's too much attention being paid to the bullying and not to the kids who are disregarded or marginalized in other ways.
Now, let me ask you this, and it happens to all authors. In my experience with authors, this is something that happens at a particular time, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be. There's that time in the process of the writing where there's this aha moment, there's this epiphany that happens, and there's a dimension of the subject matter, no matter what it is, that you didn't realize was there. It's growth time. Where was it for you?
Wow, what an excellent question. For me, it was about midway through the year when I was following the students, and I realized that the popular girl was so miserable in the popular group, but she told me, well, I can't get out of the popular group, and I don't know if I want to. But she was so unhappy, and she felt so lonely that I thought to myself, well, wait a minute. If I asked her to get out of the popular group for the sake of this book, I bet she would do it. I bet she would be healthier and happier, and I bet that it would make for a good story. So I did, and I turned that into a series of challenges where I challenged every single main character I followed, and I said, okay, let's try something different. Let's do a little experiment at your school and see if you can make over the way that other people perceive you without directly changing any of your quirks. And I think that really added a dimension to the book that I wouldn't have thought of otherwise, because it doesn't spoil too much of the plot to tell you that, yeah, the popular girl was so excited for the challenge because it validated what she really wanted, and she got out of the popular group, though I'm sure she was more surprised than I was to see how the popular girls treated her when she left the group.
You know, it's amazing when we talk about the popular girls. Look at some of these actresses today, the young actresses, talented, gorgeous. The world is there for them. And what do you hear about them? They're in and out of rehab constantly. So it also validates what you're saying. Is popularity really something that's going to be the be-all, end-all for you?
Yeah, popularity, it turns out, I delved into a lot of psychological and social science research to investigate popularity. I didn't know what being popular was like. I wasn't in the popular crowd at school. And it turns out there are so many myths about popularity. Basically, everything you think you know about popularity is wrong. There are two types of popularity, it turns out. One is called perceived popularity. That's what we think of as popular. That's reputation and prestige. The other kind of popular is being liked. And when social scientists take surveys and they ask students who belongs in which group, the groups very rarely overlap. So what that means is to be popular does not mean to be liked. It's only a status thing, and which is, you know, pretty shallow and empty.
You know, very interesting thing. You know, people who like themselves like other people who like themselves. People who don't like themselves like other people who don't like themselves. It's a commonality thing. Now, people who don't like themselves do not like people who like themselves and vice versa. And I've seen this happen time and again. You go into a group and maybe that common bond, they just don't like themselves. You walk in there and they know that you like yourself. They feel it. It's underneath the surface. You're going to be an outcast. And a lot of the kids fall into that and they don't even realize that that's what it is. A lot of the falling out of identity, falling out of the belonging to the group doesn't mean that you're any less. You could be more than that group, and they realize it and see it, and they're not going to let themselves be intimidated by you.
Yeah, absolutely. That could make you a target, and that helps to describe. So I came up with this concept that I call quirk theory, which says that the things that make you a target in high school are the same things that are going to make you admired and respected in adulthood. And so exactly what you say, that self-confidence, that liking yourself, that is a reason that people might shun you in high school, and it is a reason that people will love you as an adult.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I've got that loud and clear, and I think that the most important thing that we can take out of this is to define identity. And I think that's really what you're talking about, is to define who you are. And when you realize that who you are and why you are and why you've taken the path that you've taken, if you're into the category that you're talking about here, that if you just realize and recognize the gifts that are available, the learning process that you're going through that will allow you to move forward through a lot of those life challenges as an adult, all of a sudden the world looks differently.
Absolutely, and parents can play a big role in helping their children to realize that.
Or they should read the book.
Sure, it's okay by me.
And where do they fit? All right, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Alexandra Robbins, do you have a website we can find you at?
Oh, I do, thank you. It's alexandrarobbins.com. Two B's in Robbins, like Baskin Robbins, except I'm not related, unfortunately.
Ah, darn. Okay, and then I
yeah,
wish
I know.
I wish I was Dresser Industries, but that doesn't work either. All right, so
yeah.
We can buy the book.
Oh, yeah, you can buy the book at alexandrarobbins.com. There's a link to Amazon, which has it for only $15 right now, which is pretty good for a hardcover. It's at any major bookstore.
Wonderful. Hey, Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Good night, Michael.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. BJ Rosenfeld with us. She's the author of The Chameleon in the Closet, a conservative Jewish mother reaches out to her Orthodox sons. And as a matter of fact, she started a career of freelance writing. She taught Spanish, she taught French, remedial reading, and she's written for Boom Magazine. You know what, BJ, I'm not even going to try to say that. Cosbrus.
Wait, Cosbrus Magazine?
That one. I knew that. I want to make sure.
It has to do with keeping kosher.
No, I love every second of it. And the Jewish world. Did you hear any of the that last interview that we just went through?
Just a teeny bit, yeah.
Okay, but she was talking about people being alone, being separated, being whatever. Now, you got to imagine this. It would take you back to 1827 or maybe 1960. Mm-hmm. I'm going through Marine Corps boot camp. We're going through infantry training, and on Sundays, they brought in the Catholic priests, the priests from the different Christian sects, and so on and so forth. And up on the hill, there was me, who was Jewish, and two Buddhists and an atheist. So this was called being lonely on Sunday.
I hear you. I hear you.
Being lonely on Sunday. Okay, let me ask you this. What stimulated you to take a look at the relationship between mom and kids and the bond that's missing?
Basically, it's my story. I lived through it. So when our house has always been kosher.
Yeah.
And when my son went to college and started telling me, Mom, your house really isn't kosher enough. And he stopped coming home. And he started taking this class in Judaic studies in order to work at a summer camp. I got scared.
Scared how?
He was just not being himself. I mean, he was calling home on a regular basis, as your typical college freshman does. And we were getting one-word answers to our questions. He wasn't laughing at my husband's typical corny jokes. So I decided to call the rabbi who was teaching this Judaic studies class.
Yeah.
And before I made the call, I made a list of questions. Because I thought, thinking back, Michael, to Jim Jones and cults, I knew nothing about religious cults, but I had a feeling this rabbi might have started his own religious cult and that my son might be part of it. So I made a list of questions. Number one question was, what did you do to my son? I showed the list of questions to my husband, who said, you know, you're nuts. He's just going through a stage. That didn't convince me. I called the rabbi. The rabbi sounded so nice and answered the phone in such a pleasant way and sounded so happy to hear from me, I realized this was not the kind of sound I would normally expect from what I understood about a cult leader. And so I never did say to him, what did you do to my son? And we have had a relationship with the rabbi and his family that has gone on for year upon year upon year. We went to his kids' weddings. He's been to my children's weddings. And so when my older son, after he came home, I said to the rabbi during this conversation, by the way, I haven't seen my son in months. The rabbi said, I'll take care of it. My son came home the following weekend. And over the years, my son wound up spending a lot of time in Israel. He did graduate from college, but then he went back to learn in Israel. So basically what happened was when my son called from Israel at the age of 23 to say, Mom, I'm coming home to meet a wife. My reply was, wait a second, how are you going to do that? Obviously, you're not going to look in the yellow pages. And he said, of course not. I went to a matchmaker. And of course, I'm thinking, matchmaker, fiddler on the roof? Mom, No, things are different. There is this special girl the matchmaker wants me to meet. I'm coming back to the States to meet her. At that point, Michael, I went on and bought a journal to keep track of my son dating this special girl. I knew nothing about matchmakers. I knew nothing about Orthodox dating. And for me, this was a trip I wanted to be part of. And that's how the whole thing started. That's how my book actually began.
Now, how did she turn out?
She was wonderful.
Okay.
Absolutely wonderful. In the ultra-Orthodox world, there is no touching during dating. And she was raised very, very religious as compared to our family, which was not necessarily, we were fairly secular. Our house is kosher, but we eat non-kosher food out. So before she would agree to discuss marriage with my son, they had already been out on 7 dates. Each date was just purely sitting and talking.
So let me hold you up for a minute. Let me hold you up just for a second. Let me hold you up. Can you hear me okay? Let me hold you up for a second. I'm going to tell you a quick story.
Sure.
I know someone personally whose daughter was about 21, 22 years old. So she meets a boy. Now, she's Jewish. She was raised that way. And he is converted to Judaism. Now, so she meets the boy, and they're both about the same age. They're going out. They're having a good time together. And in the culture that we live in today, they were going to bed together, etc. Now, and they're really serious about each other. He found the same thing your son found. And then all of a sudden, it was follow the rules. We don't kiss. Mm-hmm. We don't touch. We don't. I mean, everything you said, I watched this happen. She mm-hmm. looked like she was doing okay with it. And then one night we heard that she was threatening suicide. They got her in luckily they got her in the emergency room and they took care of her, and she saw some psychologist the next day or so, and he came to see her, and it mm-hmm. broke it for him. He passed on the religion, and she was worth more than that to him. But what you're saying, I actually saw the process of that going on. It was such mm-hmm. a different cultural change that she didn't know how to handle it. She says, what am I going to do, not kiss him for 6 years and then become a baby maker? She said, that's not going to work for me. But at the same time, she loved him so deeply that she didn't want to let him go. And at the same time, she could not live that particular lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, same thing you're talking about. Exactly the same thing as you're saying it. I'm remembering what the incidences were.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
Yeah. And it's possible today. And now, is it good? Is it bad? Who knows? It's such a difference in the culture. And if you're brought up differently, you yourself personally, you know, your children do this, it's very hard. I wasn't a parent here, and it wasn't a family thing. But it would have to be very hard all of a sudden to know that child that you brought up a certain way is now completely different, and you've lost the link, the communication, the mm-hmm. connection to that child.
Right. I agree. I mean, your story is absolutely tragic. My goal in writing the book, The Chameleon in the Closet, is to keep parents and children connected. To me, that's extremely, extremely important.
Sure.
And even though my book talks about my experience with my son's decision to become ultra-religious, if you are a mother, obviously, Michael, you're not a mother, but anyone who is a mother or whoever has had a mother can relate to my story, because we raise our children a certain way. Do they live up to our expectations? Probably not. They make their own decisions. And we parents have choices to make. If we don't like the decisions our children are making, we can argue with them, push them away, or do our best to stay connected. And that was my choice, do my best to stay connected. So I now have a kosher closet in my bedroom.
Yeah. Now, I got it loud and clear. All right. So, and by the way, and with this, with the story that I told you, the boy mm-hmm. decided mm-hmm. not to follow the religion, not
right.
to be that extreme. And they're together and very happy. But it's got
right.
to be a very hard thing for anybody in the family to be able to deal with. Here's this child that you've known all of his life or her life,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
then they're different. They're so different that you don't know that kid anymore.
Well, I agree. It was difficult. It was a transition on my part. Initially, I argued with my son when he came home and said, Mom, your house is not kosher enough. I raised him my way. How
yeah.
dare he insult me and say I'm not doing it well enough?
Yeah.
And we argued. And at this point, Michael, I don't remember exactly what we argued about, but the issues were extremely important to me way back when. We're dealing with before 2001, because 2001 is the year my son got married.
Okay, but let me ask you this. What if I were
yeah.
to read the book cover to cover? I have it in front of me, by the way. And this book is going to those kids that I've talked about. I'm serious.
Thank you.
But how do you deal with that when you're to keep the connection? Do they change, or do you have to change, or is there a meeting of the mind somewhere? There's a common ground where you can connect and get some collaboration.
In the beginning, it's the parent who has to teach by example. And when you see that your child is making decisions you may not be too happy with, but they are changing their lives, you have to sit back and see what's going on. And when they start doing things, you need to start listening to them instead of automatically, which was my reaction, how dare he do this to me? I started to listen. I started to be flexible. I started to give him the respect that he actually deserved. And that's what we parents have to learn to do. It is a very difficult thing to do.
BJ, what about the respect coming back?
Well, once I was giving him respect for his beliefs, then it was coming back to me. For example, yes, I do bend more than he does. But then again, I am the parent.
No, let me ask you a question about him. Is that, you know, really what it sounds like, and mm-hmm. not necessarily your child, but a lot of them, they fall into a place where they haven't had identity. This, you know, we're talking about identity. Most of the shows end up with to be identity. But they mm-hmm. haven't had an identity. They haven't had anybody, and I'm not talking about you. They hadn't anybody strong enough to say, this is what you do, and there's discipline here. And what you're talking about, what your boy walked into, was a tremendous amount of discipline. There's kids out mm-hmm. there that need it, don't know how to get it, and then they fall into this. Luckily, it turned out to be a constructive thing.
Right.
Yeah, but what about if your child won't communicate with you at all?
At what stage are we talking about, Michael?
Stage. In the beginning, if they don't communicate, you don't have a starting place.
If they don't communicate, if they are away at school, there's got to be someone who you can contact and use that person as an intermediary. You need to get through to your child that you are willing to listen. Listening is the key in the very beginning.
Well, I think you took it a step beyond listening, BJ. I think you took it to the next step called hearing. You can listen to it, but hearing it really allows you to have some kind of grasp and understanding of what it is. So in the beginning,
you're
listening, but then you started to hear it.
Right, right.
I think that's all the difference in the world. And I really believe in my heart of hearts that if it wasn't Judaism, it could be another religion, it could be another something, that this is a very powerful story, and there are a lot of kids who fall right into this. Now, whether it's good or bad for them, who knows? This is their determination. This is for what they want to do. But the mm-hmm. extreme mm-hmm. of something usually is an indicator that they can't make it on their own, and they have to have those guidelines to live by so at least they can anchor to it and know that if there's a problem, they can fall back on it.
I don't agree 100%, but I'm willing to go along with what you're saying.
Oh, by the way, that's okay, because if this is our first disagreement, I'm leaving. I'm going home.
Okay, Michael.
And by the way, I don't have to be 1,000% accurate. There are certain things
fine.
Yeah, that you look at. And my feeling about it is there's a core message in this. And the core message, I think, goes beyond religion, and it comes right back to family. It comes right back to a level of being able to bond with that child in such a way that it doesn't limit the child's ability or capacity to be on its own and do whatever it's going to do.
100%, I agree.
Yeah. Ah, okay, one for me, maybe not the other one. But seriously, when you really come down to it. That's what it's about. And would the core of the book really be that? Is that the lesson in this?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Okay, now
the lesson is bonding with your child, staying connected. They are the most important things that we have, our children.
Sure. And there's too many parents who do not realize that, and too many kids that don't realize that also. What I would define as a family is not what it used to be when I was a kid. But you've mm-hmm. got to be able to stay with the culture and stay abreast with the culture. But family should never have changed the definition. But we find kids more and more independent today, and it's very hard or getting harder to do what you're talking about doing.
From the parents' perspective, you mean?
Yes, yeah.
I think it's always been difficult, but yeah. I think if the parent is willing and able to do his or her best to listen and hear and be open-minded, too, that's rather difficult.
Yeah, that's true, too. Now, by the way, obviously he's read the book.
My son?
Yeah. What kind of feedback did you get?
Well, I will tell you that there was something in the book that made him uncomfortable. And I said, okay. By the way, my younger son and his wife and my older son and his wife, the four of them have read the book. Mm-hmm. So with the three of them minus my older son, I said, please find something. They all found something they were uncomfortable with. So I said, please do me a favor. Give me an idea of how I can change that and still get the message across. And all three of them were able to help me out and do that. My older son found something that bothered him. And I said, please show me how I can get the message across by changing it. And he never did. So it's still there in the book.
Okay, well, good. All right. But, and the idea also here is if they find something that they're uncomfortable with, that's something that you and they, the family, needs to address. And what a great
right.
thing to be able to bring it out. And the one thing that you've done that most mothers will never, ever get a chance to do in their entire life, your guts and heart are in this thing. How many kids get to look at their parents like an open book?
I
Doesn't
hear you.
Happen. Yeah, it'll be yeah. It's wonderful. Yeah. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. My website is www.readbj.com. That's what we do with a book, readbj.com. My book is available from my website and from Amazon. And I wanted to mention, Michael, in addition to being an author, I love public speaking. I love helping parents to listen to their children and stay connected.
It makes sense. And by the way, if you're vulnerable enough and strong enough, and vulnerability takes strength, and I think we all know that, to be able to put it into a book, then there's the ability to help them out there because then they'll see it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And, and the Q&A, the question and answer that comes after I speak, for me is the most powerful.
It's the learning process. Absolutely. No question. All right, BJ, we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us. And I'm telling you, I know where this book is going.
Well, are you going to read it too?
Oh, I'll read it. But there's a couple that have to get this book because this is about
Great.
Them. Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us, BJ. Good night.
I appreciate it.
Oh, my
thank
pleasure.
Thank you, Michael. Bye.
Bye-bye. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see. Ray, you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. I thought I heard the little angel voice from the cloud saying, did we have the guest or no? Oh, wonderful. There's the little voice that came down and said our guest is with us. Stanley Bing with us, the author of Bing Sob's Fables, Little Morals for Big Businesses. He's a columnist for Fortune and the best-selling author of What Would Machiavelli Do?, Sun Tzu Was a Sissy, and 100 Bull Whatever Jobs and How to Get Them, and so much more. He's a top executive in a gigantic multinational corporation whose identity is one of the worst-kept secrets in business. And let us say, Stanley, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi.
Oh, hi, and thank you so much for being here. I think when we really deal with this and you just look at the names of the books that you've written, it really says a lot about business in and of itself. If we were to take a look at business through your eyes, what would we see differently than we think business is about?
I'm sorry. I didn't catch that last part. I'm sorry. Tell me again what you say.
Okay. Can you hear me okay? Are we clear?
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Try it again.
Okay, the key here is this: is the business in and of itself today, looking at it through your eyes, how do you see it differently than most people see business?
Well, you know, business today is not that different than business as it's ever been, except I think always there have been people inside a company. I mean, I think it's true everywhere. People working inside of a place who feel like it's pretty ridiculous. And you have to negotiate a lot of situations that, you know, you have a lot of questions about and you don't really know. It seems funny, actually, a lot of the time, but and yet it's deadly serious. So my books are aimed at helping people who see the ridiculousness of everyday life, particularly the people who are their bosses.
No, but in the ridiculousness of everyday life, Stan, we're also dealing with some great realities and some very strong and powerful lessons that would impact the way that we do business. You know, you look at Sun Tzu. I remember one of the things that was said was, if you're strong, let your enemy think you're weak. If you're weak, let your enemy think you're strong. And basically, business is run that way also.
That's very true. You are absolutely right. I mean, my books are, and this book is no different. This is Bing Sob's Fables, and each story has a moral to it. People need strategies. People need ways of dealing with things. And they are, you know, the outcome can be deadly serious. I mean, I wrote a book, the book you were talking about, Sun Tzu Was a Sissy, which was essentially the art of war, but written for today. It's about, you know, waging war in an environment where a lot of the time you may meet your adversary over and over again on the field of battle and neither of you dies. So that's what that book was about. And, you know, I wrote a book called What Would Machiavelli Do? And that book was about, you know, the central question, which is why mean, ornery people seem to do better than nice, kind people. And that's an issue that a lot of people have to deal with their senior management. In this book, Bing Sob's Fables, I took Aesop and I basically, you know, ravaged him and turned him inside out and worked him over and looked at the stories one by one and thought, you know, how would those stories and those morals pertain to people's everyday lives right now?
You know, and it's very interesting when we talk about people's everyday lives right now. The culture has changed so drastically, and those tough guys in business, when I say tough guys, not necessarily the owners, but those subordinates, the managers that have the power and so on and so forth, they're beginning to realize today we've got a completely different customer out there today, end result client. And there's got to be some collaboration between the client and the businesses themselves. And I really think that business is starting to turn around and realize they've got to create from within, because going outside first is not going to work anymore. You've got to do the best you can do with who you have. And then through networking, it can expand through there. So I really believe if you take the old fables and do what you did, turn them inside out and really take a look at them, you might find some of the very things that could cause you to propel yourself forward in business today.
You think there's a new kind of customer out there than that there used to be?
Oh, absolutely I do. You know, there was a...
How do you see that?
Okay, let me give it to you this way. I'm in the Milwaukee area now. And there is something called beepbeep.com. Beepbeep.com is a is an auto dealer website. I can go to every dealer in this city. I can see everything for sale. I can get a background check on every one of the cars sitting at my computer in my house, and I can negotiate and bid on it. Things are so transparent today that people, you can't just say anything to anybody. They're going to find out. So you've got a more sophisticated.
So you think the need for honesty and straightforwardness in everyday business dealings is greater than it's ever been before?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it has to be, because there was a time when somebody could say, drive this car, it's wonderful, and you drive it off the lot, you paid for it, it doesn't work, you're in trouble. But they
in other words, a brightly checkered coat won't sell the car anymore, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, but on the other hand, you know, we've never been in a period where there's been more dishonesty and more greediness and grotesque unfairness at very high levels than there is right now.
That's what people who are set with the amount of capital that they have. I'm talking about the average business going out there, it's a completely different story. Yes, there's greed. There's no question. Look what has happened to look how it's affected the government, the prices of everything. No question. So I'm totally on your side with that. But to run an everyday business today, it's
divide there that you're correct about. In other words, in everyday business, where people are selling something and buying something, there is more transparency and more honesty. But at the highest levels of banking and real estate and these other big drivers of our economy, and insurance, it's pretty scary, I think. I don't think there are any controls on people.
No, no question about it. And what I truly believe is what we've seen. Well, in the real estate market, you know, who knows if you really take a look at who owns the deed to your house, it's probably somebody in China at this stage of the game. Because what
you know,
they
it's funny you say that because when I got a mortgage on my apartment in New York, yeah. I got it from one entity. Okay, let's just say it's a bank and you would know the name. Okay, now it seems I'm paying off my mortgage to a completely different entity. They've sold my mortgage to somebody different.
Yes.
And I find that very interesting. I didn't have any say in that. I didn't tell them to do it. And now I'm writing my checks to somebody completely different.
And by the way, whoever you're writing your checks to, the bank sold the mortgage, and then they packaged it up with other mortgages, and then they sold those packages, and by the time they got done with the packages being combined with different packages, and the price of it going up, let me just pick a number. The $250,000 apartment is now, based on those packages and the way they're selling them, is worth $3-5 million. And if you were to sell it off today, you would find a lot of people who put money into something where it doesn't exist because the value isn't there. What they did was they increased the, So I mean, we don't have to get into that, but that's what they did.
No, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, that's why if you're a regular person in the middle of these crazy manipulations, that's why I wrote this book. I wrote this book because they are fables about good and evil and about people caught in various different kind of conundrums, different problems. And, you know, Aesop, even though he lived in Greece however many 2,000 years ago or more, these stories have tremendous resonance with us, you know, about greed and about people attempting to be something they're not and about the nature of trust. And all of these questions, although they're expressed differently in the world we live in, are the same questions that people were asking themselves in Greece. And obviously, I'm talking about investment bankers and CEOs and COOs and human resources managers and all these other characters that I populate my fables with. But, you know, the original template was laid down a long time ago, and you know, that's why we still read things like Aesop and why we read the Bible and why we read many books that were written a very long time ago, because there's something about human nature that endures no matter what kind of trials and tribulations we go through in our daily lives.
Let me tell you what I love about the core of your book. It would take you all the way back to the old mom and pop stores where you used to walk in and they patted you on the back and they knew your family, they knew the name of your dog, and if anybody was sick in the family, they knew that also. Corporations that put the mom and pops out of business. Mom and pops couldn't compete with the corporations. Corporations were doing fine for a while, and then they went multinational, When they went multinational, it's the same situation. They couldn't compete. They started losing money, so they started to outsource. When they started to outsource, people started to go into business for themselves. The entrepreneurs came out of nowhere. And I truly believe for that person who goes home, sits on his or her computer, and starts to create a business, and the business will expand if they got the base knowledge of what you're putting through in the, you know, in Bingsop's fables, then all of a sudden you might have a brand new mindset and a brand new way of looking at things, because you've got people starting from scratch before they're tainted.
Well, I really agree with you. I mean, I think the power of the individual to set his or her own strategy is what separates successful people from people who are buffeted about by the wind. And that's why all of my books are about how to sculpt a strategy in the face of what would seem like insurmountable forces that people, everyday people like you and me, have to battle against in this world, and probably always had. You know, I mean, we called them corporations, and, you know, 1,000 years ago, it would have been some other, the state or the church or the local baron. I mean, things aren't that different, I don't believe, from decade and century to century. I think it's really about whether you're the kind of person who can formulate a strategy and act on it. And that's why this book is actually a very moralistic little book. It has morals at the end of every story. It has lovely illustrations of animals, you know, because Aesop wrote about animals that were intended to be people. And I write about people who are really more like animals. So Mr. Brodner, my illustrator, has sketched weasels and lions and bears and bisons, and it's really very entertaining book.
But isn't that who we really are when you come down to it? We're the personality of that. And what's happened is we've gotten away from that. You go all the way back to when we started this country out. Who was responsible for teaching the kids survival? It was mom and dad. And as we grew, the kids got farther and farther away from home. Now, you know, the dad's not going to teach you how to ride a horse, but you've got to go and pay money in classes that the state, the government owns to teach you how to do this. And what's going on is we've gotten away from
them. Well, the problem is, you know, I mean, this week, my son, who is in his early 20s, is coming over to teach me how to use Facebook.
That's scary.
Well, I mean, it's not really scary. I mean, you know, it's great to be able to learn from your children, but in many ways, we who are over a certain age are, you know, either you learn from the kids right now, or you can just go and start chewing your cud in the middle of a field somewhere.
Yeah, but what that also does, Dan, what that also does, it eliminates the power and the strength of the family. You're talking about teaching morality. Morality begins with the family. And if there is a wall between...
I don't think that's right. I mean, my family is actually strengthened when I listen to my children and learn things from my kids. I mean, they're cool. They know a lot more about what's going to be happening in 10, 20, 30, 40 years than you or I do. I mean, we don't really know what's going on with this stuff. And I think the key to staying young and in the groove, I mean, if you're in business and you don't know how to manipulate the internet, then you just might as well be selling candy in a store somewhere. I mean, you know, you better know this stuff. And that's why I think it's important for people to listen to the younger, less powerful, weaker, but also more knowledgeable people that are cooler than you are. I mean, you know, or else you're going to be left behind. I don't want to be left behind the parade. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, but the one thing that I think a lot of the kids today miss is something that you were brought up with. It was called strategic thinking. You weren't brought up with a computer. You weren't brought up with the iPhone. You weren't brought up with the texting and the rest of it. Now, you can get somebody to teach you how to do it, etc., but a lot of these kids, if you took that technology away, Stan, they'd be lost.
I agree with you, and that's why they're so pathetic and they still need us. I mean, we need them to help understand what we need to know about this new technology.
Yes.
And this new world that's taking shape right now. We need them for that. but they need us to do the serious thinking. I mean, I don't think our generation, I'm going to be 60, okay, and I feel like I'm really 30 if my body doesn't desert me, and I don't see any reason why I can't keep pushing people around until I'm 90. Well, by the way, I know quite a few moguls who are in their 80s who are still telling a bunch of people what to do, so... But I do think you're right. I do think that younger people need the kind of strategy that I write about. You know, what do you do? Because you know why? Because they're not expert in dealing with people. They're expert in dealing with technology, but they're not expert in dealing with people, how to talk to people, how to convince other people to buy something or to share a thought or an idea. They're not very good at that, and they still need help with that, thank God. So that's why I write books.
Now, by the way, I'm totally with you. I've got 8 years on you, and in the world that I've seen and the cultures that I've seen change over the years. By the way, I'm 68, but I'm still scrappy, so I'm with you. I'm old school too.
Yeah, I know. You know, I think 68 is the new 52. That's how I see it. You know,
and yeah, absolutely.
I think 60 is the new 40. But of course, you know, you got to stay strong. So, because they are stronger than we are. They've got it on us on that. And they can also eat a 16-inch pizza and not gain any weight. So that's a big asset in the world.
Well, they should come meet this broadcaster. What am I going to tell you? When I was 63 years old, I was fighting with the semi-pros. Not getting into the ring every month and getting my nose broken, but the workouts. And I think you're absolutely right. It's up to you to stay in the best shape that you can stay in. And it also
allows... You were boxing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, by the way, when the show's over...
That is a very hard workout. If you can do that, then you're in shape.
Oh, I'm in shape. But the key really is this. I believe it's a mindset. And Stan, one of the things that you said it all, you said the whole core of the book right there. It's to compensate with that strategic thinking, that practical thinking that the computers are not going to do.
No, you know, they keep talking about intelligent computers. And I think that's something that I'd like to think that it will happen at some point. But in my view, artificial intelligence in computing, I think within like maybe 200 years, they'll be able to create a machine that is stupid, that is like the equivalent of a very stupid person, that has very little, that has like linear thinking and very little like ability to make intelligent decisions. And I think that's great. I mean,
by the way, we're starting to run out of time, but I'm going to give you this. What makes me different than the kids, and I'll give you an idea of what I'm like. Ask me who I would like to see as president and vice president. Go ahead, ask.
Okay, who would you like to see?
John Wayne and the Fonz. I mean, what more could you ask for?
Well, I don't know. You know, John Wayne is an underrated actor, but I'm not sure I agreed with his politics at any point.
No, it's not his politics. It was just the way he was as an actor. That's old school.
He was
anyhow,
great.
We're
he
about
was
out of time.
I've come to appreciate him more.
I don't even know what his politics were. But do you have a website we can find you at? Do you have a website we can find you at?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I do. StanleyBing.com. One word, StanleyBing, BING.com. And I have a Twitter site too, which is at the Bing blog. The Bing blog. But if you want to go online and just see me, all you have to do is Google Stanley Bing and you'll find a bunch of stuff. But my new website is StanleyBing.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Stanley, thank you so much for joining us. We can also buy the book there, right?
Yeah, go buy the book. Buy it immediately.
Wonderful. Okay. Hey, Stanley Bing, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Good night.
I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back, Kathy Puckett, former FBI psychological profiler in the counterterrorism unit. And her latest book is, what is that, Kathy? What's that latest book?
Homeland Insecurity, Michael. Insecurity. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well. It's nice to talk to you after such a long lapse.
I've had to go for counseling since I haven't talked to you. Okay.
Hey, well, it sounds like you've been very busy, though.
Oh, very busy. Now, let me ask you this, or let me say this, that this is the way I want to start this, okay? You can't put water on me, but you can shoot me in the head.
Well, you know, it's not torture if it's over so fast.
No, absolutely. That makes sense. We don't want to insult their whatever. You know, and you would know better than anybody else when it comes to something like this. The big argument today is we're complaining about waterboarding with a lot of people who do not feel that that's really enhanced interrogation. How's that? They don't feel that that's really torture compared to getting your eyes taken out or your hands and legs cut off. But at the same time, it was okay to go out and shoot them. Now, I have no problem with them going after them the way that they did. I have none. But my contention is how can somebody say you can't waterboard, but you can go out and shoot? There's where the problem is.
Well, I think that's interesting because I actually, in all the talking that I've done about this since this happened last week, I don't think anybody has brought it up in quite that way. And I think it's a legitimate question. It's kind of like, under our legal system, is what is acceptable under our legal system? Is it acceptable under U.S. law, for example, to muster a military force to go into a foreign country, a sovereign country, and assassinate someone? Well, it apparently is against our law to torture someone to get information, but apparently is not against the law to do the kind of military operation that was sanctioned by the president and by every legitimate body they had to do what they did. It's an interesting question, Michael. You bring up that, you know, basically it's a question of is this supersede the law?
Well,
I don't think that there is U.S. law on this.
No, but let's twist this. This is not the law. I give you UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice. These people are war criminals. They're not national criminals.
You're talking about the torture techniques, yeah. Well, you mean as far as the waterboarding. You know, Michael, this has come up as far as because of the interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the waterboarding techniques. What I think is interesting, Michael, for me, as law enforcement and also as a behavioral analyst, and to me it's important what works is important as what is ethical, but you have to have both. And for our system of justice, I think you have to have both. And what's interesting to me, Michael, is that I know Dick Cheney, who looked terrible on television, by the way. He looks like he's been very ill, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Have you seen him lately?
He's lost. Yeah, it looks like he's lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, he looks very ill, but poor man. But his immediate reaction, of course, was that this was a total justification for the waterboarding technique and getting information that directly led eventually after the years, you know, after 7 years to finding bin Laden where he was and following this career's path. The interesting thing, though, is that actually the information, the real information about the courier came from, that part of it came from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed during regular interrogation, not under waterboarding techniques. Now, that's the interesting thing to me.
Now, when I have seen, which is very interesting, that you get the leaders, all right? They get their subordinates to go out and kill, to maim, to do all these things they get them to do. But when they get caught, they completely fall apart. There's no guts there. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have is not distinguishing, and I'm going to go right back to this again, between a civilian, between a criminal, a civilian criminal, and a military war prisoner. I think there's a difference between the two, and if these people aren't enemies, then and when I say enemies, I don't mean people who just break the law. These are people who
were. No, I understand what you mean. Yeah. I understand it. This is an undeclared war, but it's not undeclared on their part. They have declared war on us.
Absolutely.
The ambiguity here, I think, is that this is a stateless organization. This is the real fundamental problem that the United States has in dealing. You know, do you deal as a military opponent? There is no declaration of war, congressional declaration of war. How long has it been since we have had a congressional declaration of war? I mean, what was the last congressional declaration of war? 1941?
Yeah, but we don't have a defined geographical enemy, and that's what the problem
exactly
is. And they know it, and that's what their strategy
is. But
it's
not just geographical, Michael. It's state related. It's that we don't have a state opponent. We have a stateless opponent.
Okay.
So that we don't have a formal declaration of war. Therefore, all of our operations, the military operations that are being conducted, are not under the general. It's just like when they were saying, does the Geneva Convention apply to the prisoners, the detainees, as they still call them, at Guantanamo Bay? This has been a continuing, you know, question as long, because of the fact that the issue of whether this is military or civil is so murky, because the people don't belong to any particular country who are our opponents.
It's a pan
extremist movement that crosses countries' borders. It isn't even an alliance. It's not even a military alliance that we're fighting like the Axis powers in World War II. It's a terrorist organization that has no state ties.
They are an ideological and sometimes a religious movement, and they're waging a religious war against us. And that's basically what you're dealing with. You got Hamas that is right across the border in Mexico creating. Let me tell you what I think our biggest problem is right now. And you may not like me for this, but you still got to love me. Okay. The biggest problem. Thank you. I think the biggest problem that we have now is this. We're giving hundreds of billions of dollars away to countries all over the place. We have our president say that, you know, we want to give XYZ country, they want to manufacture, and we want to be their client, and so on and so forth. And what's going on is we're dying at home here. There's houses being taken away. The gas is going up. I mean, I walked into the market today to get something. Now, I don't smoke anymore. I haven't touched a cigarette since.
Aren't you glad?
Oh, yeah. Since 1991. So it's been a long time, 20 years since I've touched a cigarette. Yeah, have you ever smoked?
The same time that I did, Michael.
Oh, okay. Listen, have you seen the price of a carton of cigarettes?
Absolutely. It's horrifying.
I saw it the other night, and I almost passed out. $72 for a carton of cigarettes. And they had them on sale.
How do people afford that?
I have no idea. But okay. But the point of contention is they there's a problem. So what they go out and do, they, the enemy, they go out and destroy a couple of Christian churches. They've got people they're killing all over the place. They cut off heads. They do whatever. And if we if we throw a little water on somebody, we're not being humane, and they're up in arms, and they're ready to kill somebody else. This is a problem.
Well, they do I know not that you're saying, listen. But you have to admit, Michael, that waterboarding is not throwing a little water on someone. That is not quite what it is. My whole point about waterboarding, we've had this discussion before. My whole point about it is, if it worked, I would have more reason to discuss it more thoroughly as how effective it was in getting useful information. The problem is that there is not adequate evidence. In fact, there's an evidence to the contrary that it doesn't give you reliable information.
Okay,
doesn't give you reliable information.
I'll buy that, but my feeling about it is this: that when it push comes to shove, if you're going to save people's lives and stop another 9/11, that person that you've got that has the information, there's no holds barred. That's how I feel about this. That's me personally, my own. And waterboarding, whatever the case may be, the problem that we're having now is they know, they're skilled, they're taught, they're trained, that the minute that they get caught, start complaining. You hear it?
You know how you have said numerous times when we've been talking over the past few years that no one is afraid of the United States anymore?
Yeah.
Do you think that still holds true after the events of this past week?
That's one time. You know, are we going
to... No,
look
it isn't
at,
just one time.
But look
how relentless that is.
No, by the way, yes, but look at all the opposition that we got in our own country about it. I've listened to newscasters say, well, the murder of Osama bin Laden. What do you mean the murder? You hear what I'm saying? We've got
but
an opposition.
Michael, the rest, yeah, but you're talking about people who are mouthing off within this country because they're free to do that. People in other countries, believe me, this operation, this Navy SEALs operation, is very indicative of the capacity of the United States government and the United States to do what it needs to do. And when you talk about people fearing you, I don't think that there's any question that what I find interesting is that even Dick Cheney gave Barack Obama high marks.
That's because he didn't have a shotgun in his hands.
But the whole point is that there's no denying that, you know, we've talked about before how toothless it appears that the United States has become. This is direct evidence to the contrary, Michael. I mean,
by the way, I buy it.
If there's something that if we are, you know, this has been a relentless search, and in the face of all kinds of accusations to the contrary, I remember years ago when we went for a book interview, the very first thing one of the newscasters asked me was, on film, and I remember it was on Fox News. Terry and I were giving an interview, and we were there in Fox and Friends in the morning, and the very first question out of their mouth was, when are we going to get bin Laden?
Yeah.
And at that point, it was kind of like, the answer to that is, we'll get him. But that was not a good enough answer, you know, because the attention span is so short. People are mouthing off about everything in this country because they can, because they're free to do so. The political correctness thing that we talk about all the time is a real that does drive everyone crazy who's sensible, and I understand your impatience with it. But the whole point, I think, when you're talking about, you know, does the United States have what it needs to do the hard thing? I think that this is pretty evident now.
Sure.
No question. And the rest of the world is there's a lot of big talk, but Al Qaeda is not what it was in 2001.
No. And by the way, I completely agree with that. You will not get an argument out of me. My concern is that, firstly, thank goodness that they did something like that. And as far as him being murdered, I don't care what they want to call it. That man was responsible for thousands of American deaths, and not only Americans. When he hit the Trade Center, Yeah. Well, look at everybody that was there.
It was an international. His victims were from every country practically in the world.
No, absolutely. There's no question about that. And I think the key is now people know what we're talking about. If we're going to do something, we're going to do it. So knock on wood there. The other thing I would love to see happen is if we stop giving all of this money out to all of these countries to support whatever agenda they have at the time. We need to put money into here. We need to be able to drill oil here. We need to be able to create the jobs and the economy that we once had. Because if we don't, China's going to get it, Russia's going to get it, India's going to get it, and there's a few other countries who are becoming who we were, and we are very rapidly becoming one of those countries that that we give aid to.
Yeah, I don't have the same view on this because I do think that, I know that the economic crisis in 2008, you know, is still reverberating. Oil prices, of course, are still fluctuating. I mean, I thought it was interesting that there was another big correction, though, within the last couple of days about the big drop in oil prices.
Yes.
I think you're going to see more normalization like that. You know what, Michael, I think what's interesting is that the latest announcement from the Department of Homeland Security, a joint Homeland Security FBI bulletin announcement following the killing of Osama bin Laden, is that the biggest threat right now, the most likely people to launch attacks in the United States following, you know, getting bin Laden, is lone wolves of both homegrown and internationally. And I think that being our special purview, Terry's in mind, and we were in the FBI with the Unabomber and Eric Robert Rudolph and other lone wolves that have come since. I think that this is, when this happens, this just points out that there is less unity and less organization that's opposing the United States. What we have to watch out for are these outliers.
Yeah. See, but the whole problem with all of this, it seems as though our attention is outward instead of inward. Kathy, that's my entire argument. Take care of what you've got.
I understand what you're saying, Michael. We need to take care of business at home. And I think that, and as far as talking to me, I mean, as far as national security and everything, you know, I'm somebody who focused on national security members issues and counterintelligence my whole career in the FBI and work on threat assessment and things like that. So my purview is not necessarily domestic prosperity. So I bow to you on that. I mean, I have no argument with you on the fact that we need to be more in control of our own economy and our own economic future. I don't know. I don't have any specific answers on how to do that, though.
and I got that loud and clear, but I do believe that when you really come down to it and take a look at it, that what if you were back in the FBI now, if you were in counterterrorism now, you'd see a completely different style out there than you did when you were in. And you weren't in that long ago. I've got that loud and clear. But the point of contention is we live in a different world, different cultures, and different mindsets. And because of that, we have to look at things extremely differently. My goodness, I'm proud to be an American. I don't want somebody burning my flag on my own home territory. I don't want, you know, there's so many things I don't want when it comes to that. I look at this and I watch how some of the kids' attitudes are today about this. No, am I an extreme conservative? Of course not. You know I'm not. That's not where I'm at with any of this.
No.
But my goodness, respect what you have, respect why you're here, and if somebody does come here, why would you leave a place that you were frightened to death of and come here to be able to express yourself and have freedom and then try to make this place like the place you left? There's where my problem is.
That's been a question for forever, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's always going to be that way. And we're about out of time, so the time goes so quick.
Well, it's nice to talk to you again. Listen, you can catch us on our blog. We're going to update it soon. HomelandInsecurityTheBlog.com, Michael.
Wonderful. Kathy Puckett, see you next week.
Talk to you soon. Okay. Bye-bye,
bye-bye,
Michael.
Fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many
exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you.
Victoria Bowman with us, PhD, Dr. Victoria Bowman. She's the author of You Gotta Have Guts, The Natural Way to Enhance GI Health. She's a healthcare professional, author, and a speaker with more than 30 years of expertise in cleansing, detoxification, digestive, and gastrointestinal health. And let us say, Gloria, Victoria, welcome to the show. I'm going to get hit for that one. Victoria, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good.
Are we
Hi.
On now?
How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
Good. Victoria, can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Can now, let me ask you this, Victoria. When you deal with natural health to enhance GI health, GI health is so critically important, and most people just pass it right off. They don't realize how critical it is. What are some of the things that the average person can do to pay attention to that gut, because most of us don't, and because of that, there are a lot of inherent problems?
Well, when we think about our gut, we need to start with our smile, because our teeth are there to help us chew our food. And so digestion can't be improved if we don't start at the top and actually mix our food with our saliva, which has an enzyme in it. Then we go into the stomach and we digest proteins and fat, and then it dumps into the small intestines. So if you don't start right, it's not going to end right. But we need to think about a lot of things that are going on, and something as simple as observing what our elimination looks like can tell us problems that we might have had in the digestive process.
Okay, now, that's a very interesting
point.
So
we would take a little glance before we're done.
Okay, now, how is it supposed to look? And when I say that, from what I understand, if there is enough fiber in the stool, it floats. I mean, there's certain colors that the stool is, which would be an indicator of what's good or bad in that GI tract. So what do we actually look for? Or let's do it the reverse way. What is something that if we see, we know there's a problem and should take care of it?
That's a great question. Well, the first thing is if our stool sinks to the bottom, or it looks like what I call little submarines or little hard balls, there's not sufficient probiotics in the stool. It could be toxic with, say, heavy metals, and so it's sinking. A healthy stool should float just below the waterline. Now, another thing we can see in our stool is whether or not we're digesting our oil or our fat. So we know that oil floats on the top of water, so if the stool floats above the waterline, then we either have too much oil and fat in our diet, or we're not digesting it. And the other thing is as it swirls and goes down the drain, if it leaves a residue on the porcelain, then that's also excessive oil or fat. Now, the color will determine what we're eating or if we have a problem. If we see an army green stool, then we're probably dumping bile, and there's an inner relationship between our liver and our bowel, so we need to think that the liver might need some support just as well as the digestion. But the color of the stool is determined by what we're eating. A pure vegetarian will have a light tan stool. However, it may be influenced by beets to turn it reddish tan, or green drink that would make it greenish tan. Whereas someone that maybe eats fish and fowl will have a slightly brown stool, and someone that eats red meat will have a darker brown stool. I don't consider any of them wrong or bad. It's just an indication of what you're eating and how well you're digesting it.
Victoria, I remember about 10, 12 years ago, my stool was black, and I didn't know what it was. 2 days later, I passed out. They took me to the hospital, and they almost lost me on the table. I was bleeding internally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Blood that's, if we see red in the stool and it's blood, then it's usually just a hemorrhoid that's kind of popped open and bled. But when we see a black stool, there's something drastically going wrong in the GI tract, and you got great medical attention. That's wonderful.
No, it happened real fast. I was there. So when we're looking at this, you are a homeopathic physician, right?
I have a PhD in homeopathy and natural medicine. I'm not licensed as a homeopath because my education doesn't allow that, but I have the education.
Okay. Then what you look at basically is traditionally how to handle things as opposed to conventionally. Allopathic medicine obviously is the chemicals. Many people say, if you have an ill, take a pill, all right? But in the end result, if you really take a look at your body and the inner workings of your body, you're more apt to be able to deal with it. And I think that in and of itself is critical. It all started with, food. And from that, we created the chemicals that allow us to, in a lot of cases, just cover the symptoms that we have. So does a lot of it have to do with the food you eat and then your ability to digest? So it starts with what you put on that plate first.
I agree. We could call it death by fork.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we also need to remember, and I loved your previous guest because we're talking about personal responsibility, and that's something that we need to do. And when we're proactive about our lifestyle choices, the food we eat, the exercise we get, good rest, good water, these are things that can make a large change in our health with very little expense.
No, and I hear it loud and clear because when you think about it, the way things are working today, whatever you put on the table, and even if it's vegetables, it from the time that it left where it was created at to the time it hits the market to the time it hits your table, you got maybe a couple of weeks. It's lost a tremendous amount of its nutritional value. Then if your digestive tract isn't working properly, it's going to be diluted, and by the time it gets there where it's supposed to go to do what it's supposed to do, it doesn't have the power.
You're right. A number of years ago, about 20 years ago, I came across some research out of The Lancet, and it was talking about using a bacterial preparation rectally for intestinal disorders. And I read it and read it and read it and said, I need to know more. And what they did was they actually took, during a bowel exam, and introduced probiotics into the four people, and everybody got better. Now, two people had chronic constipation, one had a flu-like problem, and the other one had irritable bowels. Again, the medical model is to use antibiotics and antifungals and antiparasitics and sterilize the gut. I don't want to do that. I simply want to clean the gut and then introduce the healthy probiotics so that we can bring about the homeodynamic balance to the bowel. And I've had incredible success in so many different types of bowel difficulties.
Now, by the way, let me ask you, I want to make sure we get this also. On your website, is there a product, is there something that we can get to fix this problem?
Yes, and it's called reflorestation. So the flora is the balance inside the probiotic flora. And so it's called reflorestation because we're reintroducing it into our guts. It's called an at-home colon kit. And yes, it's on my website.
Okay, so effectively we can find it on the website. The gut in and of itself, as powerful it is as it is, it's also very sensitive. And my feeling is this, if you understand the base dynamic of how it works and learn how to feed it properly, and feed it doesn't mean necessarily food, but with the enzymes, the hormones, the whatever it takes to get it working properly, all of a sudden you lead a better, healthier, and more fulfilling life, and you don't have to be laying in bed or in pain or at the doctor's office every other day.
I would agree with you. The thing that I found about the reforestation and doing it the direction that I do it is the fact that when we digest hydrochloric acid and pepsin, which is predominantly in the stomach, digest protein and fat, and it lowers the pH in the stomach to 3 or less. Now, probiotics thrive in an environment of 6.4 to 6.9, and they can survive perhaps as low as 4.6. So what happens is when we take our probiotics by mouth, even the enteric coated ones can be affected, the low pH is going to affect the probiotics, actually survival. Now, this is the low pH is important because if you're exposed to E. coli, it's going to kill it. But if you're exposed to probiotics, lactobacillus and bifidus, it's going to kill it too. It's non-discriminatory. So those that we take by mouth, we have a 3 to 5% delivery into our small intestine, and then it has 22 more feet before it gets to the large intestine. So by doing the reflorestation, we're only going 6 inches in through the rectum, and it's delivered 50 billion and 22 varieties.
Wow. Now, the pH is that determines your acidity or your alkalinity. Where do you get that balance in the stomach? Or does that come from that the forestation that you're talking
about? Yeah, a lot of people think that we should be alkaline, and I agree. However, there are variables. Our bladder can have urine in it no lower than a pH of 5. Our stomach at rest is about a pH of 3, and it can go down as low as 1.5 for those that have really strong gastric juices. But our blood is basically about 7.3, 7.35, and if it varies too much, we're in a critical state. So there's a variety of pHs within the body, but the stomach itself has an extremely low pH, and that's to digest protein and fat.
So this is the difference between accidental and intentional results with your gut. And so the process that you're talking about, how many times a week do you have to do it?
Once. In fact, my clients that are healthy probably only do it twice a year. They're very strong, and they are prolific. So once they're introduced, they replicate themselves. However, life shows up, and sometimes we get into food that maybe has been sprayed with pesticides or other things, and so there's a slow deterioration over time, and so what happens is 6 months later, we repeat it. If you clean your teeth at the dentist every couple of times a year, it's a good idea to work on the opposite end.
Okay, so in essence, what you're really dealing with is going, quote-unquote, directly to the source to deal with it. And I think that's extremely important because if you swallow it, quote unquote, it's going to go through processes and it's not going to get the full value. And there's going to be a degree of dilution along the way. And if you take it from the other end, quote unquote, like you said, it goes right to where the source is, right where it's supposed to be. And it works and it's strong.
And you know what? Bacteria love dark, moist, and warm. And they're just really happy when they're administered in this manner.
That's funny.
You know, something we know is that 60% of our immune system is in our intestines. So what I found was not only did it improve GI health, but it also supported the liver because there's an interaction through the portal vein between the large intestine and the liver, the kidneys, and the immune system. So when this is done, we find that our immune functions are stronger.
Okay, and there's one thing about the immune system that I do want to bring up, which is critically important. You can have all the medicine in the world. Nothing is going to cure you. Everything is to build that immune system. It's the immune system that does the job. And when there's a disconnect, when it's lacking something, you become vulnerable. And when you become vulnerable, that's when you get sick.
You took the words out of my mouth. You're absolutely right.
Okay, so it's going right to the source to build what needs to be built in the place, quote unquote, that it needs to go to get your full benefit. Now, what's the website? How do we find you?
The website is myreal, Health, MyRealHealth.com. My book, You Gotta Have Guts, is also available as an ebook from Amazon for those that like it in that format.
Okay, now, by the way, Victoria, are you doing workshops? Are you doing seminars? Are you doing private counseling? Are you doing any of those things?
Yes, I am. I'm in private practice in Phoenix, Arizona, and I have numerous interviews and conferences coming up in the next 6 months.
Okay, how is the medical community accepting what you have to say? Or is there resistance? Are they fighting you, or are they starting to say, okay, let's take a look? Because the biggest problem with the medical industry is the pharmaceutical industry, and that is ruled by dollars, obviously.
I agree with you. Fortunately, Arizona has some very progressive and strong holistic laws. So we have a large community of holistic practitioners, and they embrace what I do. About 6 weeks ago, I presented at a conference, and there were a number of conventional physicians there that heard my presentation. And when I have a chance to spend an hour with them, they'll come back to me and they'll say, this makes sense. So it is being embraced more and more. And like many of us that are in the, quote, alternative or holistic field, we've been touched in our own lives, which is why we looked outside the box. And now these other individuals are having circumstances happen in themselves, their family, their friends, or in their practice, and they're starting to look for other alternatives. So it is being embraced slowly but surely.
Okay, and in essence, more and more people are finding out about it. And that's what I'm really hearing you say.
That's right. And they're looking beyond medicine because when they've spoken to their doctor, 40% of the American public struggles with their bowels. And they talk to their doctor, and their doctor says, drink more water. And there's more pieces to the puzzle. It's a multifaceted answer. And once it's put together correctly, there's rapid success.
Now, by the way, with the gut in and of itself, what we haven't talked about, we're running out of time now, but what we haven't talked about is all of the other areas of the body that is affected by what you do or do not have supporting that GI system.
You're right. The important thing about a colon that has healthy bacteria, it is more than just the trash can that we're waiting for our weekly pickup from the dumpster. When we have healthy bacteria, our colon actually manufactures certain nutrients. B12 is one. Vitamin K is another one. It also absorbs nutrients that might have been missed by the small intestine. So we become nutrient rich. Then it has the capability of binding to toxins to remove them during our elimination. Now, we have both water-soluble toxins and oil-soluble toxins. Well, it's easy to get rid of the water-soluble ones. Go into a sauna. But when we have an oil-soluble toxin, it's held in the bile, and the colon actually reabsorbs the bile so that our liver can use it again for more protein and fat. Well, if you have healthy bacteria, it's actually able to pull the oil-soluble toxins out of the bile and eliminate it so that what's being recirculated to the liver for reuse is healthier, stronger, and cleaner.
Wonderful. Hey, Victoria Bowman, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And again, one more time, please, with your website.
MyRealHealth.com. MyRealHealth.com. Michael, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Good night, Victoria.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you look on for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small.
Scott Brown with his third generation towing company with 35 years personal experience in the towing and roadside assistance industry. And he's the founder of 1-800-TOW-FREE, T-O-W-F-R-E-E, TOW-FREE. That was in 2008. And we're talking about towing, roadside assistance, accident recovery, GPS location, the technology, the E911. And this is the big one. 1-800-TOW-FREE is launching a national affiliation program to create a system similar to the E911 that automatically connects customers to the closest approved facility offering guaranteed low rates and the first 5 miles free or 10% discount, whichever is greater. And Scott Brown, welcome to the show.
How are you doing, Michael?
Oh, I'm doing great. Scott, thank you so much for being here. I think this is critical because one of the most important things that we can talk about tonight, and people don't realize this, there has been a deregulation of the towing industry, and that means that anybody can charge anything they want to charge. How close am I with that?
Well, that's actually true. A few years ago, they deregulated the towing industry, which has brought about quite a few opportunistic towing companies. They get customers on the phone, they go out and they respond to the accident or the tow and end up charging the customer, you know, 2 to 3 times what the actual cost of the tow should be.
So in essence, what you're dealing with when you talk about TOW-FREE, the roadside assistance, what we've got here in the affiliate program is almost a regulation. When I say regulation, you've got people all over the country, different businesses that fall under one auspices. They, you know what you're going to be charged ahead of time, and you know what the benefits that there are to be offered is ahead of time. So I think that in and of itself is critical.
That's true. It takes the risk out of the tow. You know, a lot of people take that chance and they call randomly through the phone book, or they look to see, you know, who they can find to get somebody to come out and get them. And usually they take a long term to come out and get them. It's going to take 2 or 3 hours or more to respond to a call. And so if they call through 1-800-TOW-FREE, we have a new technology that will actually GPS locate them. It'll be online in a few months, and it'll locate the person in general where they're at, and it'll actually connect them to the closest towing facility. That'll knock down response times tremendously.
So you got basically what you're really saying globally, not just nationally.
Correct.
Global.
Well, right now it'll have to be based in the United States and Canada. Once we go past those areas, the 1-800 numbers don't take effect. So it's hard to actually locate those persons until we do that, yes.
Yeah, but the idea is no matter where you're stuck, you can find me if I'm part of the program. You can find
Correct.
Me. And again, you connect me with the closest tow service that I have. Now, what else is offered? And it's not just towing.
Well, that's kind of the beauty of it. You know, you mentioned it's kind of you got to be part of the program. You really don't have to be part of the program. All you have to really do is call the phone number. Once you call through the phone number, it will actually locate you. It will ask you if you'll allow us to locate you. Once you hit the button for let us locate you, then it automatically connects you. You don't have to be a part of the program. You could be just an average cash customer off the street, and you don't have to worry about the cost of someone coming after you that's going to overcharge you. And that's what's made the business so tough lately. You know, you see a lot of things on TV and a lot of the companies who really take advantage of the customers. And, you know, I can show you stacks and stacks of complaints that people have made against towing companies. And I'm trying to eliminate that factor. You know, where they have one number they can call anywhere in the country. It doesn't matter. You know, they don't have to actually look up a phone number for a company, find them, you know, like I said, through the phone book or through a friend. They can automatically remember the number, call it, automatically connects them to that closest company.
Now, one of the largest companies out there are doing, and I'm going to say similar, not what you're doing, but what about the auto club? Does the auto club have any strength to do it? Are they anywhere near what you're doing? What would happen if I did call the auto club as opposed to what would happen to me if I called you?
Well, typically at auto club, what they do is they come in and they sell you a policy for roughly, you know, $120 a year. They throw some 10% discounts in on top of that and try to make you feel good about it. You know, granted, some auto clubs, I believe, are fairly decent companies. But for the most part, what they do is they call the towing companies out and they try to pay them $25. So they'll go through a list of towing companies. They'll actually take your call, then go through a list of towing companies before they find the company that will actually come out and service your call, which is a safety factor because you're sitting on the side of the road and you're waiting for a tow truck. You think one's really on the way when really that's probably not true. They're probably searching through their list of towing companies to try to get someone to come get you. What happens is they only want to pay that towing company around $25. So the towing company will actually put you at the bottom of the list. So if there's a one tow across town paying $65 and there's your tow maybe 2 or 3 miles away paying $25, they'll automatically go to the $65 tow first. Now, that's not always the case, but I would say about 90% of the time that's true.
You know, when you look at the overall program, one of the things I like about it, let's face it, we do not live in a very safe world anymore. 20, 30, 40 years ago, it was fairly safe. Today, if you're stuck, you have no idea what's going to happen to you. So if you know you've got the GPS, you know you've got somebody tied right into you, you know you've got somebody that's going to be out there fairly quick, there's quite a safety factor in there, isn't there?
There's a huge safety factor. I mean, you get so many incidents nowadays. It's just getting crazy and crazier out there. And if you're on the side of the road or your daughter's on the side of the road, whoever, you know, in your family is on the side of the road, you don't want them there very long. You know, there's been several incidents where people have been hurt for being left on the side of the road for too long, and they ended up taking a ride from someone they shouldn't have, or, you know, doing something against their own best interest that they, you know, they feel like it's their only option at the time. You know, they've waited on the side of the road for 2 or 3 hours. It's starting to get dark. You know, what do I do? I can't get out. You know, what should I do? So they end up doing something they shouldn't. They get out of the car and walk. They end up getting hit by, you know, in the dark by a passing vehicle. You know, things like that that just shouldn't happen. Now, I forgot to mention a while ago when you were speaking about the auto clubs, on average, about for every $360 you spend with an auto club, which is about 3 years worth of membership, you usually would have only used their service one time, which probably would have cost you around $65. So the cost far outweighs the, you know, you could save much more money just by not joining an auto club together, you know, all together. Just, you know, use your towing insurance on your actual insurance policy. You know, a lot of insurance companies, I'll say one in particular, State Farm offers a policy for around $9 a year that is very comparable to what a big auto club would offer, and they actually pay higher rates, so the towing company tends to show up quicker.
You know, there's an interesting point here as I'm listening to what you're saying, that, you know, with the auto club, you pay a set amount every year or for every 3 years, whatever it is, and you join. What I'm hearing you say is the people who join, the affiliates, are the towing companies. And if I'm out there and I get stuck, I can just pick up 1-800-TOW-FREE and you got me.
That's correct. That is correct. Yeah. We have affiliates. Right now we're based in Oklahoma. We're growing on a national basis. If you call the phone number and it tells you that there's not someone close enough, we want to make sure that our customers know that we don't have, if we don't have someone in the area, we let them know very quickly that we don't have a tow truck in their area, then they should call the local police department and try to get someone dispatched immediately to them. And that way there's no waiting around, there's no confusion, and it makes it much safer for the customer just in general.
Oh, no question. You mentioned something about something on the auto policy insurance. Now, will insurance pick up the cost, basically, and in general?
They will. You know, the average tow is usually somewhere between 5 and 15 miles. Most, say State Farm in general, for one, again, will usually cover you up to 20 miles. So they'll average, you know, covering the tow bill. You know, if you end up pulling a long distance, which very rarely happens, you know, over 20 to 30 miles, then you might have to a few dollars out of pocket, maybe $10, $15, $20 out of pocket. But in general, you know, you're better off to go with your actual towing insurance on your policy. Like I said, if you're a cash customer, you can still call 1-800-TOW-FREE. We'll still give you the first 5 miles free and or a 10% discount. We also offer a 15% discount to veterans, seniors, and college students.
Now, by the way, is this starting to, the idea starting to spread? The people who are becoming your affiliates, the towing companies, are they starting getting excited about this? How did they hear about you?
Well, you know, I kind of started this company about 2 years ago. I've got tired of the same old type business where you go out and you try to do the work for the auto clubs, and you can't really keep your business going for the $25 that they want to pay. And I knew there had to be a way to get directly connected to the customer. You know, obviously, all businesses who eliminate the middleman can end up giving the customer a better deal. And so, when we started building the national program, where we started having more and more towing companies where people could call and they felt like they could call that number and they knew that we could offer direct insurance billing to their agent. So initially the call is free for them. You know, we offer that we'll go to wherever their agent is, we'll give them a call, make sure they cover the tow, we'll go out and take care of the customer. And it just really caught on really quickly and started getting a large number of calls almost within the first 6 months. And so we've been doing it for about 2 years now, and it just keeps growing and growing. And so I'm really excited about it.
Scott, I can't imagine that somebody, especially in the economy that we have today, then there's shortfalls in every business that there is. But if you take a tow company who obviously may not be making the greatest money in the world only because people are not traveling as much, and they come on to something like this, well, that's money in their pocket. That's business they would not have normally gotten because of that phone call that nobody knew where they were or how to get a hold of them that somebody's found on the GPS. So as far as I'm concerned, this affiliate program that you're starting has got to it's got to skyrocket. It's got to just explode pretty soon.
I can see that happening very quickly. It's already starting to get quite a few responses from towing companies all over the U.S. It's been quite exciting, and I'm very happy about it. Something I forgot to mention a while ago is one of the reasons we created Tow Free was for the customers who, you know, we had one customer in general that was, you know, on a Saturday afternoon she was driving to Walgreens to get medicine for her child, and she only had about $80 on her, and we went out to take. She had a flat, and the average flat cost can be, you know, $50-$60 to change that flat. And so the cost out of her pocket would have been very expensive for her to pay for that, and she would not have been able to buy her kids medicine. And so we actually found out that she was a State Farm customer. We ended up billing directly to her agent, saved her the cost, and we really want to make sure that this is a customer-friendly program. It's really all about the customer. You know, more so than the towing companies, it's more about the customer and giving them a better service faster, at a better price. And anytime you eliminate the middleman, you can do that.
So what we're really dealing with is if somebody has a problem, no matter where they are, you pick them up on GPS, you find an affiliate that's close to them. And then I think, did I hear you say or not, so stop me if I'm wrong here, that if you don't have an affiliate in the area, you'll give them an idea where to go.
That's correct. Yes, we always let them know quickly that there's no one in that area that can actually handle the service for them. We actually direct them to the local police department. If you go through the local police department in a deregulated industry, if you actually go through the police department to contact a towing truck, they're actually bound by those towing rates through the police department. And also through 1-800-TOW-FREE. But if you actually call them through the phone book yourself direct, it's called a consent tow. On consent tows, the towing company can charge anything they want. And that's where you have to be careful.
Okay, so in essence, there is a lot to know about a towing company, and I think that in all my experience of driving for many years now, that there are so many things I didn't even think about with a tow company. And I think if you ask the average person on the street, what will happen if you have to get towed? For the most part, they could not answer the questions. They wouldn't know. So a lot of this has got to be getting that word out so people understand the probability, number one, of having an accident, but number two, what can happen when you have that accident? And there are so many things, or not accident, if the car gets stuck. And there's so many things that do happen today that you don't have to have a bad consequence for. It can be handled, and I think this is in and of itself an absolutely brilliant idea. Now, let me ask you this. Is there a question I didn't ask you that I should have asked you that would have brought information up that we, the audience, need to hear because what you're saying could save a life?
Actually, I don't believe there is. I believe you brought up most of the points that we'd like to talk about this evening. So,
wonderful. Okay, so it's 1-800-TOW-FREE. Scott Brown, do you have a website we can find you at?
We do. It's actually 1-800-TOW-FREE.com, or you can just go to TOWFREE.com. It actually shows a map with all the locations of the towing affiliates that we have and their direct numbers if you'd like to do it that way. But actually, it'll all connect them directly. You really only have to remember the one number. Once you remember that one number, it'll connect you directly to that towing company, the closest one to you. It's a no-risk towing.
Wonderful. Hey, Scott, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
All right,
you can hurt us long as we- we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some sax in them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm. Then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing now, long as we're singing now, long as we're singing our song.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Dresser After Dark. I'm going to leave you with this attitude by Charles Swindoll. The longer I live, the more I realize the impact of attitude on life. And attitude to me is more important than facts. It's more important than the past, than education, than money, than circumstances, than failures. It's more important than success, than what other people think, say, or do. It's more important than appearance, giftedness, or even a skill. And it'll make or break a company, a church, a home. The remarkable thing is that we have a choice every day regarding the attitude that we'll embrace for that particular day. You can't change your past. You can't change the fact that people will act in a certain way. You can't change the inevitable. The only thing that you can do is play on the one string that you have, and that's your attitude. And I'm convinced that life is 10% of what happens to me and 90% of how, and listen to it very closely, how I react to it. And so it is with you, and you are in charge of your own attitude.
Is more to me than a pleasure, 'cause me and music, we go together like notes in a measure.
Hey, and thanks for listening. And if you're listening on the web, tell all your friends about it, no matter where they are. That's the way we grow, and that's what you call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.